NPR News. I'm Rick Ganley.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been called the first speech of his re-election campaign. President Obama's State of the Union address last night to Congress and the nation. With the economy gaining strength, the president repeatedly urged lawmakers to send him bills he said would help create jobs. But he also said he'd do what he could on his own if Congress didn't act.
And we've come too far to turn back now. As long as I'm president, I will work with anyone in this chamber to build on this momentum. But I intend to fight obstruction with action, and I will oppose any effort to return to the very same policies that brought on this economic crisis in the first place.
The speech was almost all about the economy and creating what Mr. Obama called an economy built to last. That includes, he said, investments in education, infrastructure, and domestic energy. Also a tax code that favors businesses who keep jobs in this country. Republicans chose Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels to respond to this speech. Governor Daniels said the president didn't cause the economic and fiscal crises facing our nation. But in the last 3 years, he said, Obama has made things worse. Today in The Exchange, we'll hear highlights from the president's speech and get your reaction to it. What themes did you hear in it? And which struck a chord with you? Which do you think were off base? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College and director of the Center for Civic Engagement there. And Wayne, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Peter Josephson, associate professor of politics at St. Anselm College and co-author of the forthcoming book, The Irony of Barack Obama. And Peter, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thanks, Laura. It's good to be here.
Well, and Wayne, I'll start with you. Your broad reactions, first of all, to this speech, and then we'll get into the details.
I thought it was an excellent speech. I was thinking last night as it was winding down that it seemed longer than usual, and it was 65 minutes long. We haven't seen many State of the Unions over an hour since Clinton's days, so that was a little bit different. I thought the bookending of the speech at the beginning with the discussion of bin Laden and the end with SEAL Team 6 and talking about serving the country was masterfully done. And I guess at the end of the day, I came away thinking there was a lot of Reagan optimism in the speech and a lot of Clinton attention to detail. I thought it was a very good speech.
And we'll get into some of the detail. But broadly, what do you think, Peter?
I actually think Wayne is completely correct about that. I was struck, too, by the bookending. That is, beginning with what many voters perceive as his strength, international relations, foreign policy, and then coming back to that in the end, in some respects, in ways that might make some people a little bit uncomfortable, but certainly beginning and ending with what many voters perceive as his strength. And then Wayne's right, that Clintonian attention to detail, and I thought also a very nice balance between governing and campaigning. I was prepared for a campaign speech. This wasn't quite a campaign speech, but it had some elements of that.
It certainly did, and we'll talk about those. But both of you have mentioned the bookending, and a lot of people have noted that the president opened by praising the military, praising their successes abroad, and saying, hey, if we here in Congress and in Washington could come together, imagine what we could accomplish. Let's hear what he said.
At a time when too many of our institutions have let us down, they exceed all expectations. They're not consumed with personal ambition. They don't obsess over their differences. They focus on the mission at hand. They work together. Imagine what we could accomplish if we followed their example.
So, Wayne, that's a nod to the extreme partisanship that we've seen in Washington this year, right?
Right. And I think the narrative that our government, our system of government in Washington is broken has really taken hold for a lot of Americans, a lot of frustration that that Washington just isn't doing the people's business, that that it is, in fact, broken. And so this idea that the president is appealing to members of Congress to let's get roll our sleeves up, let's get to work, we've got the people's business to do, is going to be a powerful campaign theme, I think, going forward. And I think it's also a stark contrast to what we're seeing versus the in terms of the Republican nomination contest, where there's a lot of back and forth now between Newt and Mitt. So you have a real interesting contrast that's being set up between the president's vision, his hope for what will happen going forward, and what's happening on the other side.
Yeah, that's a campaign theme, too, that we heard, in addition to, hey, let's come together and accomplish great things for the country, Peter. Wayne's right. The other theme is, you know, let's have some economic fairness in this country. Fairness, at least according to what Mr. Obama would characterize as fairness.
Well, but, you know, he spoke actually in on several occasions quite colloquially about that. But it seemed to me that if we were to just hear the speech and give it our own sort of title, we would call it the fair shot. That was the phrase that he came back to again and again. We've had a square deal and a new deal and a fair deal. Now we're going to get the fair shot. And it seemed I thought that was actually a pretty smart way to frame the issue. That is, this is a fundamental issue of fairness, a fundamental issue of justice. Let's make the campaign about that. It seems to me that that plays into a lot of the anxieties in the country that an Obama campaign in 2012 could appeal to.
A fair shot in terms of taxes. Wayne, go ahead, jump in there.
Yeah, when Mitt Romney finally releases his tax returns and we learn that he paid basically 14%, right? You juxtapose that against what the president is saying about that doesn't seem fair. The average American is paying 30%, you know, for those who actually pay taxes. So, you know, this issue of basic fairness is, I think, the central theme to the campaign, and it resonates with the average voter because it just seems inherently unfair that a billionaire is paying so little while those folks who get up every morning and go to work each day are paying quite a bit more.
Well, and this came up in the speech last night. He called it again the Buffett rule, where billionaire Warren Buffett pays less percentage-wise in taxes than his secretary. Warren Buffett's secretary was up in Michelle Obama's box. Mr. Obama did hit what the Republicans often say this rhetoric is. They call it class warfare. Let's hear what he said about responding to that theme that we've heard from Republicans.
When Americans talk about folks like me paying my fair share of taxes, it's not because they envy the rich. It's because they understand that when I get a tax break I don't need and the country can't afford, it either adds to the deficit or somebody else has to make up the difference. Like a senior on a fixed income, or a student trying to get through school, or a family trying to make ends meet. That's not right.
Again, that's President Obama in his State of the Union address last night. Today in The Exchange, we're playing back some highlights from this speech and getting reactions to it. Let's hear from you, too. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Give us your thoughts on this speech, if you watched or listened to it last night. What campaign themes you heard, what broad themes you heard about getting the economy moving again. 1-800-892-6477, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Well, Peter Josephson, there's this rhetoric about let's make the tax system fair, and then there's the reality. You know, President Obama and the Democrats have tried to change this tax system before, repeal the tax cuts, the Bush-era tax cuts for the top earners. It hasn't happened. It's been a very difficult struggle. So why keep bringing it up?
Well, I think, first of all, my guess is that the president does not expect to accomplish that this year. It seemed to me that that's a campaign moment. And when he says that the top rate ought to be a 30% rate, that, I think, is not going to happen between now and the election. I'm quite sure that that's not going to happen between now and the election. But it is... It is a kind of peak in any speech about taxes that he can give for the rest of the year. That is, as a campaign moment, to say this would be my goal for the next 10 or 11 months might work for him. As a matter of governing, as a matter of a policy that we will accomplish between now and the next State of the Union address, my guess is, no, we're not going to accomplish that.
Wayne, what do you think?
No, that's exactly right. I would be shocked if we accomplished very much at all between now and Election Day, right? And that, not at the risk of being cynical. This is a campaign year, and so they're all sort of locked in on their positions. Look, This is very much a campaign and political speech last night. There is a lot of economic populism going on. These kinds of arguments appeal to average voters, and that's why they're made. You don't lose anything by going on the campaign trail and saying, I believe in this. I'm going to work hard for this. And then when the Republican do-nothing Congress, which is what they're going to say, opposes it or doesn't act on it, you've really just set yourself up nicely with a nice argument with the voters. So this is a very smart approach.
Okay, but I want to ask you about that, Wayne. You know, you said these economic populist messages like the one we just heard from the president, you know, make the wealthiest Americans pay more, play well with voters. If that's the case, why doesn't it change? I have heard that some Americans don't like this idea of soak the rich because, you know, the American dream is, hey, I'll get rich one day myself and I won't want to pay more in taxes. So I'm really wondering if this plays broadly across the country.
That argument about class warfare does resonate with some voters. And remember, the only national election we're having in November is for president. The other elections are local or they're regional or they're statewide. And there are different values across this country. And for some, this argument that a government that is more active, that is doing more, that is larger, that is going to take my hard-earned money, right? That is anathema to the values of a lot of voters in this country. So, you know, there is a counter-argument. The president just has a very powerful bully pulpit. And last night, unlike the debates, unlike the primary contests, he's unopposed. He speaks, even though there's a response. He speaks, he captures all the attention. And he makes a very strong case. Now the response will have to be made over the course of the next months.
Yeah, what do you think? Add on to that, Peter, if you could. Again, this doesn't resonate everywhere.
It doesn't. And, you know, we talked earlier about the idea of the fair shot. The president in the clip said this isn't about envy, it's about fairness. To be honest, it's probably a little bit about envy and a little bit about fairness. Probably both sides have something to say about that. But if the campaign is going to revolve around this idea of the fair shot, then we're going to have a conversation about what is fair. Why is it fair for the wealthy to pay 30%? Why is that the fair number? Why not 25% or 20%? Why is it fair to tax capital gains differently from wages? Maybe it is, but that, it seems to me, I don't have high hopes for political rhetoric usually, but that is the conversation I'd like the country to have.
Well, and we're having that conversation somewhat in the Republican primary itself. So, all right, more on that after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls. Let's get your thoughts, feedback, reaction to President Obama's State of the Union address last night, 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members. And support also comes to us from PSNH, proud supporter of a University of New Hampshire study on New Hampshire habitats and wildlife. More details can be found at www.extension.unh.edu. And from Holloway Motorcars of Manchester, authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer, featuring the 2012 S550 luxury sedan with fuel-efficient twin-turbo engine and iconic design, benzcars.com. More on President Obama's State of the Union address on the exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, another look at the State of the Union address. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny for most of the state. High temperatures 35 to 40, mostly cloudy for the North Country. Highs there near 30. Tonight, partly cloudy. Lows near 5 above, north of the White Mountains, near 15 in central in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, reactions to the State of the Union address that President Obama gave to Congress and the nation last night. We would like to get your reactions now at 1-800-892-6477. If you watched the speech, what did you think? What themes do you think were spot on? What seemed off base? What more did you want to hear in the speech, perhaps, that wasn't there? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. My guests are Peter Josephson with St. Anselm College and Wayne L'Esperance with New England College. And gentlemen, one of the big themes out of last night was an economy built to last. And one of the major ways that President Obama said that economy could be built to last was to boost American manufacturing.
If you're an American manufacturer, you should get a bigger tax cut. If you're a high-tech manufacturer, we should double the tax deduction you get for making your products here. And if you want to relocate in a community that was hit hard when a factory left town,
You should get help financing a new plant, equipment, or training for new workers. So my message is simple. It is time to stop rewarding businesses that ship jobs overseas and start rewarding companies that create jobs right here in America. Send me these tax reforms, and I will sign them right away.
Okay, a couple things to look at there, guys. First of all, Wayne, to you, you know, this call to manufacturing, it's stirring rhetoric. It got the whole Congress applauding madly. Is this a reality, though, to boost American manufacturing back to the heydays of the 50s?
Not to the heydays of the 50s, and not in those kinds of jobs, right? The old days of the steel mill, you know, of the Detroit auto plant. It's just incredibly difficult for American manufacturing to compete with, you know, on a global level. But what the president was talking about, he sort of alluded to, was sort of this new high tech, these new industries, these new technologies where we do have an advantage, particularly in clean energy industries, where the United States can become a leader. And so the idea of creating manufacturing jobs around that, that requires greater levels of skill and education and technology, I think is an interesting approach. The challenge is, you know, whether you're a Republican president or a Democratic president, there's always a laundry list of things you want to do. And there's never any discussion about how you pay for those things. And so that's where the devil in details will be.
And also that idea of bringing jobs back to our shores. Peter Josephson, you also hear this from politicians of both parties, but it doesn't seem to change. How come?
Well, really, because the causes of the problem are so deeply rooted and so out of our control. The decline in manufacturing is a 40-year-long problem. We noticed it 40 years ago.
And this outsourcing.
Sure. So Wayne's right. The idea that we can return to the heyday of the 1950s is it's not going to happen in those jobs. In part because the heyday of the 1950s was an artificial high. Our economic competitors, Germany, France, England, Japan, China, had all been decimated by war. So, of course, we rode high economically in the 1950s. By the 1970s, it was pretty clear that that wasn't going to last. When we try to solve the problem of the decline in manufacturing, we need to know that the causes of that problem are historic and largely out of our control. And that's why the president's turn to a kind of vision of tax relief and an interesting program of government support for the development of new high-tech clean energy manufacturers is really intriguing. He's speaking – many people say, oh, he's doing a new kind of thing. He's really doing what Alexander Hamilton, as Secretary of the Treasury, said that the government ought to do in building a national economy. Thomas Jefferson hated the idea, of course. this is a debate that's been going on for more than two centuries.
So just pick up on what you said, though, Peter, and Wayne, I want to hear from you, too. You said, you know, it's great to say bring jobs back to our shores, but this is out of our control, largely. So there really isn't any major policy changes that a president or a Congress can make to bring these companies back whole hog, so to speak. Is that what you're saying?
That's true. Now, the president did, with respect to energy and the environment, he did suggest that it is in his power by executive order, and I think he's right about this, to order that the federal government in its fleet vehicle purchases and in its construction and particularly through the Department of Defense could, by rule, say we are any rehabilitation of old buildings, any new construction is going to be green. The federal government is the largest construction company in the United States. And if it does that, then suddenly green construction becomes a multi-billion dollar industry. Presumably we get all kinds of economies of scale and so on. That actually could make a difference.
Wayne, to you and then our callers.
Just very quickly, I mean, so let me put on my political glasses and sort of to look at this speech. So when you talk about manufacturing jobs, you're talking about a lot of union jobs, right? So that's talking to the base. And this is a very political aspect of the speech. You notice that there's a lot of mention of cities like Charlotte and Raleigh and Dayton and Pittsburgh. These are swing states in this coming election. The president is very much focused on those. Today, I think he's in Kansas City. So the president is making trips out to these swing states. He's talking about them. He's talking about creating jobs in those states. It's hard not to see this for what it is, and that is speaking to folks that he wants to get to vote for him come November. It's not unique to this president. Every president does it, but it's certainly a lot of that last night.
Interesting. And here I innocently thought that he was just picking nice examples that fit the story. But you're saying, no, those were very targeted.
Wait. Sure.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Give us your thoughts on the president's State of the Union speech last night. What worked, what you liked, what didn't work in your mind? 1-800-892-6477. Chris is waiting in Manchester. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It was interesting to me as I watched the State of the Union last night for the first time for this or any other event. I sat down with my computer and tracked the process through social media, through Twitter and Facebook, to get feedback during the course of the speech and then the GOP response to that. And what really stood out to me was the level of vitriol in the comments that were being distributed fast and furious. Reactions were very knee-jerk, and there was no sense of listening or considering to what he was saying. It was just automatic on both sides, either, yay, I'm for it, or, you know, this is not something, you know, this is completely ridiculous. And I found myself thinking, you know, am I watching the same speech as what some of these folks thought?
Well, what was the main critique, Chris, that you saw on social media?
Well, the main critique was that whenever the president said something was white, the opposition automatically said it was black. The spin or the perception of what he would say, regardless of the program or of the topic, it was an automatic negative response to that. And it seems to me that, you know, this is the first president that really rode the wave of social media to get elected, but he's going to be the first incumbent to really feel the brunt of the influence of social media, and he's really going to have to manage that from his opposition. It was quite extraordinary.
Well, Chris, you are an astute political observer, and Wayne Lesperance, what do you think? I'm sure you were paying attention to social media last night.
I was, and I was tweeting the whole time, and maybe I'm one of those folks that Chris would notice. You know, those mediums lend themselves to instantaneous, which means very quick, which means not a whole lot of thoughtful responses. You only have so many characters, and there is a premium placed on snarky comments. You want to get people to notice you, you make a really snarky comment. So I think to some extent the medium helps to promote that. But I think Chris's larger point, that this is a president that inspires a lot of reaction, both positive and negative, is very much true. And it's instantaneous, and it's very loud. There's a cacophony of noise coming from social media on both sides. So he's right. This is a challenge of the modern presidency.
Interesting. Well, and there was, of course, the official Republican response, which is always given after the State of the Union speech. The party chose Indiana Republican Governor Mitch Daniels to make the case for the GOP. Let's hear from Governor Daniels.
Contrary to the president's constant disparagement of people in business, it's one of the noblest of human pursuits. The late Steve Jobs, what a fitting name he had, created more of them than all those stimulus dollars the president borrowed and blew.
What did you think about the Republican response? It went on for about 15 minutes, largely saying, Peter Josephson, that the president's continuing to think that government spending is going to solve our problems, and, of course, Governor Daniels disagreeing with that.
I thought Governor Daniels did a very, very good job. I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans who wish he were running for president. There are probably a lot of independents who wish he were running for president, too, and maybe some Democrats who are glad he's not. I thought he did a very good job, and in part because he was very critical, and I'll say something about that. But at the same time, there were moments in that speech in which he was very fair. What I mean is President Obama didn't cause this crisis. There are, if one reads the social media vitriol, there are those on the right who think Barack Obama caused the problem, which is false. We can just say that, I think. And as I said, the causes of the problem are going to be much more complicated than that. So I thought it was a very good response. I do think that both President Obama and Governor Daniels made a similar rhetorical error. And that is, the president calls for a kind of post-partisanship. He's been calling for that since his speech at the Democratic Convention in 2004. Let's get beyond red states and blue states to become the United States. And that's part of the promise of what he said he could bring to Washington. In this speech, that was articulated especially by the Navy SEAL metaphor at the end. Why can't we be more like the Navy SEALs? Which is to say, won't you stop disagreeing with me and everybody get on board? But Mitch Daniels makes exactly the same argument. This is class warfare. You should stop disagreeing with me and get on board.
So I'll be bipartisan as long as you see it my way?
Yeah, exactly. But both sides are saying it.
Uh-huh. Right. Go ahead. Did you want to finish up there?
Well, only that there is both sides seem to have this belief that we can accomplish a kind of harmony in politics. Which I think is not what politics is, and certainly not what politics in a free society ought to be, it seems to me.
Our phone number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Chris, thanks for that call. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, another caller from Manchester. This is Paul. Hi, Paul. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Why, thank you very much. I listened to the President's State of the Union last night on the radio.
Great.
And I was very, very impressed with this demonstration. A very, very strong leadership and calling other people to, you know, get aboard. And I don't think it was combative. I think it was a demonstration of an ability to lead.
So you made you feel optimistic, Paul, about the country, given, you know, that the economy is sluggish and we're divided. Made you feel a little bit better.
Well, the thing that made me feel...
Okay, I think Paul's having a little trouble with his radio there. But I heard from other Democrats, Wayne Lesperance, too, that this kind of, you know, put their chins up a little bit more.
Well, and you know, one of the criticisms the president has faced from Democrats early on, and then certainly from sustained criticism from Republicans, is an absence of leadership or a failure of leadership. And I think you heard a speech last night that was designed to demonstrate, you know what, Mitt Romney's running around talking about running companies, I'm running the country. And that it was a really strong show, I think, of leadership in that speech.
Peter, jump in there, please.
Well, I agree. I think, a recent poll out just in the last day or two shows the president's approval rating now at 53%, which is the highest it's been in a long, long time. That'll change, you know, in the next 10 months or so. But I thought the president, I think Paul's right, that the president did a very good job of being assertive without being... too harsh, I think. And I'm sure that will give Democrats quite a lot of uplift. It seems to me that probably goes back to some speeches he made in September. Coming out of the summer, coming out of the budget negotiations and the debt extension negotiations and so on, there was a real shift in his rhetoric toward a more campaign style. It's difficult to maintain a balance between the kind of speaking that's required in a campaign, the kind of flattery, for one thing, we're the hardest workers in the world and that sort of thing. We heard that a lot last night. And the kind of political evangelism, that is, we are and always will be the greatest nation on earth. The president has said he's not comfortable with that kind of talking. He's good at it.
He's good at it. Right?
But he's not really very comfortable with it. He's much more comfortable with the kind of cool, professorial, if I can put it that way, professorial approach to politics. But that doesn't sell very well.
That doesn't get people going, yay, at the campaign rallies.
And even Democrats who say we want politics to be done in a different way don't really like the professorial Obama.
Wait. Right. Democrats want to see governing happen in a different way, but campaigning in the old style, right? And so those two things often mismatch. Look, the president, this is where he is best. He is best on the campaign trail. He's best giving those stump speeches and those very uplifting, empowering, that kind of rhetoric that really inspires. You know, the problem is, you know, the RNC released a video today that compared this speech to a speech a year ago. And there is language that is verbatim the same on multiple issues. And so what Republicans are going to do is say, that's great. You give great speeches, Mr. President. But you said this was a priority a year ago. What have you done with it?
Well, you know, you both mentioned Mitch Daniels saying, no, the economy didn't melt down because of President Obama. But Mitch Daniels said he's made it worse. The president also had some defensive lines in his speech last night saying, look, don't pin this whole economy on me. He said a lot of it happened before my watch. He also said a lot of it happened because we didn't have the structures in place to prevent it from happening, specifically looking at the financial sector. I want to hear what he said on that and then ask both of you what you think about it.
Some financial firms violate major anti-fraud laws because there's no real penalty for being a repeat offender. That's bad for consumers. And it's bad for the vast majority of bankers and financial service professionals who do the right thing. So pass legislation that makes the penalties for fraud count. And tonight I'm asking my Attorney General to create a special unit of federal prosecutors and leading state attorney general to expand our investigations into the abuse of lending and packaging of risky mortgages that led to the housing crisis. This new unit will hold accountable those who broke the law, speed assistance to homeowners, and help turn the page on an era of recklessness that hurt so many Americans.
What do you think about that, Wayne? An era of recklessness. We're not going back to that, he said.
I think that plays very well with Main Street. I think there's a very wide-held view that a lot of folks have lost their homes, are losing their homes, are barely making ends meet because they are the victim of predatory lending practices and credit practices because nobody was watching, you know, minding the store while this stuff was happening. So I think to hear a president talk about wanting to make sure we rein that stuff in, that we deal with that so it doesn't happen again, is very popular. What that actually looks like, that's the challenge. But I think as a theme or as a message, it's very strong.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. From Westminster, Christian's calling in. Hi, Christian. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
I thought the speech by Obama was overly ambitious. He speaks from a record of failure. I mean, all you have to do is look at the facts. Daniel speaks from his state is a record of success. And also, this president probably, unfortunately, will be reelected because 47% of the people pay absolutely nothing to the government, state or federal. So you know they are going to want to maintain the status quo. They are going to vote for this guy because they know if the Republicans get in office, they're going to have to go to work. They're going to stop these false things like income earned tax credit and the rest of it.
So the tax fairness thing doesn't gel with you, Christian.
It does not. His speech was all BS, and I can't believe those puppets sit there and applauded this guy who has a record of total failure. I cannot believe it. Just look at the facts, please.
All right. Christian, thanks a lot for joining in. We're going into a short break, but we will tackle your points after that break and take more of your calls. So join us 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
State Impact is a new project between New Hampshire Public Radio and NPR. NPR's political editor Ken Rudin has been helping to shape the project and its mission.
It's one thing to just cover what the legislature does. It's another thing to cover how it affects people. What happens in Concord is very, very important to what happens to businesses and communities all around the state.
And State Impact New Hampshire is telling the stories of those communities and businesses on NHPR and NHPR.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Collins Dentistry for Children, treating the dental needs of infants through teens in southern New Hampshire with locations in Nashua and Pelham. Details at collinsdentistry.com. And Antioch University, New England and Keene, offering multiple master's and doctoral programs in environmental studies and resource management and conservation. AntiochNE.edu. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with New Hampshire's new Department of Transportation Commissioner, Chris Clement. Email us your comments and questions for the commissioner before the program. Exchange@nhpr.org is the address. And then join us tomorrow morning live at 9:00. Today, we're looking at President Obama's State of the Union address last night, some of the themes, we're playing back highlights, and getting your reaction at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. And Wayne and Peter, just before the break, we heard from Christian, who said he thought the speech was overly ambitious. And to quote him, Peter, he said he felt like the president speaks from a record of failure. What do you think about that?
Well, two things. First, I don't know that he's overly ambitious, but he is very ambitious.
And a lot of this stuff in the speech we have heard before.
Sure, we have. That means that the president is aware that he hasn't done it, and he still wants to do it. I would guess that if we went back and looked at Ronald Reagan's State of the Union addresses, there would be themes that reverberated through the years, things that he felt he hadn't quite accomplished early on that he still wanted to do later. As to the idea of a record of failure, that is half true. Most of what we hear about Barack Obama is half true. He has a record of failure and he has a record of success, depending on what policies one favors, I think. That is to say, he's failed at some things and he succeeded at other things. That goes to two other points. First, a kind of deep question about how much power any president actually has. We're in the middle of a political campaign. Those who support candidates other than Barack Obama probably expect that if my candidate is elected, the world will change. And it won't.
Although I have to say the president did have, early in his term as president, all Democrats in control, and still a lot of these policies didn't change, whether it's bringing jobs back from overseas or reducing the deficit or investing in education. So you could say he had a pretty good chance early on.
He had a very good chance early on, but, we faced the problem that King Louis of France faced just before the revolution in 1789. That is, this expectation that he's the most powerful man on earth. If he's not solving our problems, it is because he doesn't want to, he doesn't feel our pain, he's not interested in some way. He might be the most powerful man on earth, but there is the rest of the world that he's not in charge of. So we need to have more sober, more realistic expectations about not just what President Obama might do, but what a President Romney might accomplish as well. These people are not powerful enough to produce sunshine and light.
Well, and just quickly, Wayne, if you could, picking up on Christian's point. And Christian, thanks again for calling. He said 47% of Americans pay no taxes and they're going to love what President Obama is saying about, let's make the wealthiest pay taxes. Is that right? 47% of Americans pay no taxes?
It's close to half. Close to half of the American people don't pay taxes. Federal income tax.
They pay the payroll tax that's taken out of their paycheck.
Sales taxes. They pay all kinds of other taxes, but in terms of federal income tax. That's the other argument. When Republicans say, sure, we'd love a fair tax, how about we start with everybody paying something into the federal income tax coffers? So that's part of it. Just one other quick point. The Constitution says that the State of the Union is supposed to be an updating of Congress on the State of the Union, and the president is supposed to share his ideas or her ideas about measures that should be taken going forward. President Jefferson used to send a written State of the Union. This idea that it's ambitious, right, if you look at its constitutional origins, is right. In the modern presidency, however, the State of the Union is all about political theater.
So everybody does this.
Everybody does it. You have a joint session of Congress. The whole world is watching. Of course it's going to be ambitious. Of course it's going to be over the top. That's what they do.
If it isn't, then everybody says, boy,
that was a lackadaisical speech. Right.
No ambition, no goals. Peter, real quick.
You don't get to be president without wanting to be the next Lincoln or the next Roosevelt or the next Reagan. Most presidents fail to be the next Lincoln or Roosevelt or Reagan. Obama wants to be the next Lincoln and the next Reagan. That's what he wants. So, of course, he's ambitious.
Well, and there were so many issues that came up last night. We won't get to all of them, but one I really did want to talk about with both of you is immigration, because this has come up in the Republican presidential campaign. There have been some differences among the Republican candidates on this, an issue that lots and lots of presidents talk about, but we seem to keep going back and forth on. Let's hear what President Obama said about immigration, and then I'd love both of your thoughts.
I believe as strongly as ever that we should take on illegal immigration. That's why my administration has put more boots on the border than ever before. That's why there are fewer illegal crossings than when I took office. The opponents of action are out of excuses. We should be working on comprehensive immigration reform right now. But if election year politics keeps Congress from acting on a comprehensive plan, let's at least agree to stop expelling responsible young people who want to staff our labs, start new businesses, defend this country. Send me a law that gives them the chance to earn their citizenship. I will sign it right away.
Okay, guys, help me out here. Peter, is he trying to have it both ways here? Let's stop illegal immigration, but if you're here already, illegally, you know, let's help you join the military and rebuild our economy. I'm confused.
Well, it is a mixed message, clearly. It is a mixed message that John McCain tried to send in 2007 and 2008. It's a mixed message that Newt Gingrich is trying to send now, both of whom agree, at least in the broad perspective, with the policy that the president outlined last night. It was at that moment that in talking about immigration, that the president pointed out that illegal immigration is way down since he became president. That's true.
He said because of his
But that's not why.
Boots on the ground. It's because of the economy.
It's because of the economy. So again, we come into this, you know, how do we apportion causality? How do we say, oh, he deserves praise for this? I don't think it's because of anything he did, really. But it happens on his watch, and so he takes the credit for it.
How's this going to be talked about in the general election, Wayne? Immigration?
It's a tough issue. Hispanic voters, you know, the number one minority group in the country, Hispanics, there are two very different streams. There is a very strong law and order element to Hispanic voters, but there's also this group that Republicans very much need to court for the future of the party among Hispanics, and the DREAM Act with them is something that's fairly popular. So this is the idea of young people being able to stay for college.
If your parents brought you here when you were five, right, and so forth.
And so it's a very powerful message. Let me just hit one other quick point. In three of the cuts that you've played today, at the very end, there's some line to the effect of send me the legislation or send the legislation to my desk and I will sign it. That's a really powerful message because what he's saying is, look, do nothing, Congress, do something, or I'm going to remind the American people every day that you didn't do anything, even though I have these great ideas. So I think it's part of a powerful message.
Yeah, another message last night that took a lot of the speech was on energy policy. And here again, the president had what he called, oh gosh, my memory's escaping me, but it was sort of all of the above strategy, I think is how he put it. Let's hear what he said about production of domestic energy.
Over the last 3 years, we've opened millions of new acres for oil and gas exploration. And tonight I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources. Right now, American oil production is the highest that it's been in 8 years. That's right, 8 years. Not only that, last year we relied less on foreign oil than in any of the past 16 years.
Okay, Peter, so defending his administration's record on domestic production, this has been a big critique in the Republican presidential campaign, right? That this president wants to shut off domestic energy production. That seemed to me to be a direct response.
It's certainly a direct response, and to some degree, it's a legitimate response. He has opened up areas off the east coast of the United States for offshore drilling. He gets zero credit from that on the right, and actually probably not enough blame if one is on the left. To say, on the other hand, that it's a result of his policies that oil production in the United States is up now, previous to what it was, you know, 8 years ago or at one point 25 years ago. Probably that has something to do with Bush administration policies, given the lead time that corporations
need
in order
to
begin
to
their drilling and to work through the system.
Investments up and running.
So if we're going to say that this is a good thing, probably the Bush administration deserves some credit for it, too.
You know, I was listening to what he said about energy, and again, there was a lot there, Wayne, and it took him a good couple minutes before he got to what his progressive base likes, which was the alternative energy, you know, right, the wind and the solar and so forth. How come he put all the, all the fossil fuel energy first and the clean new energy got second shrift here?
I think in difficult economic times, voters are less concerned about the environment than they are about the bottom line. And so Having access to cheaper fuel or more fuel, which would hopefully drive down gasoline prices, is a very real pocketbook issue for voters. Your point is exactly right, though, Laura. There were three points last night in which the president probably caused quite a bit of upset for his progressive base. One was on this issue of offshore drilling. The other was the standing shoulder to shoulder with Israel the way he did. And the third was saying very Republican, almost bellicose language of no options are off the table when dealing with Iran.
I was struck by that, yes.
That was a very muscular, very Republican in many ways statement. Not that the policy of the United States towards Iran has changed a whole lot, whether it's Republican or Democrat, but that kind of language was very powerful. And I thought, if I'm a progressive and I'm a supporter of the president, those three points are sources of concern. Peter's right, not enough to, you know, change anything, but certainly something that you're going to read about in progressive newspapers and blogs today.
Some disappointment.
Yes,
on that energy policy. So that's a play to the middle, Wayne, then. You know, the progressive presumably will vote for Obama anyway, even if they're not loving his energy policy.
And that's the calculation. You're going to vote for me. Who else are you going to vote for? You win elections by playing to the middle, and that's exactly what that was last night.
That's why he starts with oil. Because, we all listen in this way. We hear the first sentence. We hear the second sentence a little less clearly. So the first sentence has to be the political sentence. That is, let me talk to independent voters about how I am supporting oil production in the United States and natural gas production in the United States. Then I can talk to the folks who are already on board about alternative energy. Wayne's right. You have to start with the thing that's going to appeal to the voters you're trying to reach.
Let's take another call. And Dick is calling from North Conway. Hi, Dick. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I did not hear anything in the speech last night about campaign finance reform. It's kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Nobody wants to talk about it. But until it is talked about and addressed constructively, it really promotes a lot of empty rhetoric and the paralysis that we see in the Congress, because our Congress is really beholden to the money and not to we the people.
You know, Dick, thanks for calling in. Wayne, I heard a little bit about campaign finance reform, but not in the classic sense that most people consider it. So, Dick, I think you're right about that. But there was a little bit about it.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about the role of Congress receiving money from interest groups. And, so, for example, if you're on the banking committee and you're receiving donations from a banking firm, there ought to be something done about that. That is probably the least sexy kind of stuff to talk about in the State of the Union, because it's very inside politics. But I think Dick is exactly right. The postmortem on this election is going to be all about super PACs. It's going to be all about the massive amounts of money coming from very few people on both sides of the aisle. We're hearing a lot about it on the Republican side, but boy, I'm willing to bet that, you know, there'll be quite a bit of it on the Democratic side as well. So it is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and it is getting very little attention paid. And no one's going to talk about it during the election process because they're all banking on that money now.
Well, I'm looking at the speech right now, and I found the paragraph. And again, yes, it's sort of small details, Wayne. Right. It's not campaign finance reform writ large. Any reason why he wouldn't do that, Peter?
Yeah, there sure is. His own record is a little sketchy in this regard. That is, and I don't know that he's different from past presidents, right. But the record of folks who bundled campaign contributions for him in 2008, getting access to the White House and to White House officials, there's an extensive record of that. So it's a little difficult for him to get up and say, I'm shocked to find out that this is going on, because he's doing it too.
Well, Dick, thanks for that call. Here's an email from Andy in Dover. He says, your guest accuses Obama of saying that he wants an end to partisanship only if Republicans see the issues his way. But two of the specific issues that he promoted in the speech to spur growth were deregulation and corporate tax decreases, which together make up the entire plan put forth by Republicans. And he asks, how is that not a sincere attempt to be bipartisan? What do you think, Wayne?
I think that the president created linkages last night between those issues and tax reform and other things that are more typically Democratic. It is a bipartisan approach to some extent in that, you know, he's willing to give up some on this on the one side of the Democratic issues if the Republicans are willing to give up on the other side. You know, when we said at the onset of the show that it's very likely that nothing's going to get done this campaign season, that might have been a tiny bit of overstatement. There may be some things done at the margins. And this may be one of those kinds of issues, but I wouldn't hold out a whole lot of hope.
Well, and I don't want to forget the other foreign policy highlights of this speech. Although it was probably, you know, Peter, 80% economic, He did, as we said, mention Iran. He mentioned Israel. A lot of folks this morning, Peter, are saying President Obama's assessment of Afghanistan was more optimistic than perhaps it should have been.
Yeah, probably a little more optimistic. There are areas of Afghanistan where the policy is going very well. But, you know, he made a decision in 2009, November 2009, that he wasn't going to try to reconstruct the entire country of Afghanistan, that he was going to focus in certain areas. Work in some of those areas seems to be going very well, but not in the rest of the country, because that hasn't actually been the policy. Now, whether that produces any sort of long-term achievement in Afghanistan, I think is unclear. And Afghanistan is not an isolated country. What happens in Afghanistan obviously is connected to what happens in Pakistan. What happens in Pakistan obviously raises concerns in India. What happens in India obviously raises concerns in China. So this is, you know, we point to Afghanistan often as a problem that somehow is a discrete in a bowl. We can solve this. But in fact, it's a huge issue. He's had marginal success. But I'm really concerned about what the next 3 years in Afghanistan look like.
Well, Wayne, just to finish out, so all these themes we talked about, how do they get played out on the campaign trail from here on out, both from the president and his opponents?
I think we saw the first salvo last night. He's going to go state to state to state, say, I want to do all of these things for you. The Republicans are blocking me. And that's the frame for the Democratic frame going forward.
All right. Well, both of you, thank you very much for taking the time to come in today. Peter Josephson, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. It's good to be here.
Peter Josephson, Associate Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College, co-author of the forthcoming book, The Irony of Barack Obama. Wayne Lesbrons, great to see you.
My pleasure, Laura. Thanks.
Wayne Lesbrons is a professor of political science and director for the Center for Civic Engagement at New England College. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Karen Gold. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.